Welcome to the OA Light a Candle Meeting podcast. Visit our website at www.oalaig.org, where you'll find three separate speaker feeds with over 300 speaker files, links for you to subscribe to the podcast, and a place where you can donate to keep the special service active. I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Helena. Hi, everyone. My name is Helena, and I'm a compulsive overeater and restrictor and sugar addict. I want to say hello again. Hello, OA family. Hello, OA family here in LA. Hello, OA family in New York. If you're listening, I just moved here from New York in March and celebrated 2 years in August. And just want to say hello to Brooklyn, Stonehouse. What's up? Miss you. Love you. You guys got me started, keeping it going. I also want to say hello to the newcomers here tonight who had the courage to come to this meeting or come back to this meeting if you've been gone. I want to say hello to the person that might be listening to the podcast who might be in relapse, or maybe they are just sitting in their home alone, terrified, and they don't want to leave their house, but they feel desperate and out of answers, and they are looking for some hope. So if you're listening, I am sending you love, and I want to say one thing to everyone in this room and to anybody that's listening, and that is that I love you. I love you, and I love every person that is listening to this podcast. And I can only say that because of this program. And in the 2 years I've had of abstinence, I've learned to love myself. And I've also learned that I cannot give what I haven't been given. I can only give what I have been given, and I can only keep what I have been given if I give it away. So I have been given so much love by this program and by the people in these rooms and by the people that wrote our literature. The people that came before us, the love, the legacy of love just goes on. And I hope that somebody listening tonight feels a little bit of love from me and from the other people that are listening, because this program is uniting us. Okay. I have 2 years, as I said. 2 years of abstinence. I found the willingness to recover one day at a time for 2 years. And to me, the willingness is, it's the willingness to admit that I'm powerless. One day at a time, I have found the courage to admit that I'm completely powerless. Not just over food, definitely over food. I'm definitely powerless over food, but I am powerless over everything. I don't have any answers. Prior to coming into this program, I thought I had them all. I had done my research, you guys. I had read everything, every diet book that had been written, every cookbook, every magazine article. And I maintain to this day that I am one bite away from a binge, and I'm one article away from a cleanse. I mean that. It sounds funny, but I mean it completely earnestly. I have not... Thank God, to this day, I have not ever tried a cleanse. But I'm also not bulimic. I've never thrown up, and I've never starved myself to an unhealthy weight. And let me add this word, yet. I have not done those things yet. And the only reason I haven't, I fully, wholeheartedly believe, is because I keep coming back to these meetings. So to the newcomer, when you hear someone say, keep coming back, we mean it. We mean it. And we don't mean it because we want your money. We don't mean it because, you know, you make us feel better about ourselves. We can congratulate ourselves and pat ourselves on the back so we got one more. We've reeled in one more of you. No, we mean it because we've been there. We've sat where you are sitting. We know what it feels like to feel terrified and powerless and to not have the answers. I'm going to go into what it was like for me growing up, but before I do, I want to share what it was like for me my first meeting. I came in on a Sunday. I had sat that Saturday night before, binged, and it was a usual binge for me. It was a binge that only a person with this disease can do, and that means someone else was in the room, but I found a way to do it without them knowing it. My husband and I lived in a one-room apartment in Brooklyn, and you better believe I found a way to binge on food that he didn't even know was in that house. And I did this on the regular, you guys. There was no, I did this regularly. I had been having heart palpitations, and I didn't know why. I would be sitting, watching TV, sitting sideways on my love seat, facing the TV, so my legs were sprawled in front of me at an almost recline, but I couldn't recline completely, because if you're completely reclined, it's harder to eat. And had just gotten some kind of delivery. In New York, we call it cheeseburger deluxe, and that means that it comes with everything. It comes with fries. It comes with everything on top. And I don't know what happened. I blinked, and it was gone. I blinked. And I had been experiencing heart palpitations for a few weeks. You know, I probably had been experiencing them for a few years, but I'd only become aware of them for a few weeks. And I had a friend who was a nurse, and I called her, and I said, I'm having heart palpitations. I don't know what's going on. And she said, you're probably dehydrated. Drink lots of water. Well, she's probably right. But what I didn't tell her was what I didn't realize. I had binged, and I had been binging. I was completely oblivious to the fact that I was binging. That is the insidiousness of this disease. Alcoholics have binge blackouts. They had alcoholic binge blackouts. I had food binge blackouts where I was doing it and didn't even know I was doing it. I had no consciousness of how much food I was eating. To this day, I cannot tell you what a binge looked like for me. I remember certain times, certain, you know, situations, but I can't tell you what my worst was because my mind shut off. That's how this disease works. It shuts us down so that we can just fill that God-sized hole with whatever's in front of us. This recovery is threefold. It's spiritual, physical, and emotional. Did I get that right? Emotional? Did I get that right? Okay. I'm going to assume I did. Thank you. And I have experienced all three of those things. Just to get my numbers out of the way, I do not come from big numbers, and that is only because I came in when I did. I have in 2 years lost about 2 sizes. I don't really get on the scale. When I do, it doesn't say what I want it to say, and that is none of my business. I do not have a doctor telling me I need to lose weight yet, but if I do have a doctor tell me that, I am willing to do what that doctor suggests. Having said that, I do recommend finding a doctor that is OA friendly, because I have gotten the following advice from doctors before when whatever diet I was on was failing me. One was the cookie diet. I had a doctor say to me, oh, you know what, I just lost a ton of weight. I didn't even exercise. Here's the number of this doctor. These are the cookies I ate. You just eat them 3 times a day, and it's great. I've lost 60 pounds, however much it was. And I thought that sounded fantastic, and the only reason I didn't try it is because it's too expensive. And another doctor told me to eat more. Add more foods to your diet. I'm laughing because I don't think I could have added more food. Whatever types of food she wanted me to add, I don't think I could. But I am willing today to alter my food plan if I'm instructed to do so by somebody that might know more than me. When I came in, no one knew more than me. I was an expert. And today, I don't know anything. I've lost 2 dress sizes. I have done that using this program. I work the tools. I work the steps. I actually have 2 sponsors. Oh, that is such a blessing. It's kind of special circumstances. I'm not saying anyone needs to have 2 sponsors. I have my food plan. My food plan is no sugar, no gluten, no cheese, and 3 meals a day, 2 optional snacks. Just to give a little detail, cheese is not an alcoholic food for me. I've had it once in the last 2 years. That food plan was given to me by an acupuncturist, and cheese is just not healthy for me. I had it once because it was an emergency situation, and I called my sponsor. I bookended the meal with calls to my sponsor, and I had serenity about it. So that's just getting that stuff out of the way. Let me go into what it was like. I was conceived in a Volkswagen van, and don't worry, I'm skipping ahead. I'm not going to start at conception. I don't think there's enough time in a weekend for that. But I tell you that only because it gives you an idea of the environment I grew up in. My parents were hippies who I have to say, because my mom would kill me, they did not do drugs. And my dad worked. So I was conceived on a camping trip in Oregon in a Volkswagen van. And I grew up in a home that had a lot of love and sometimes had some sanity. And I was cared for. My mom made clothes for me. I have an older sister and two younger brothers. My mother didn't work, so she was able to spend time with us. My father did work, but was very, you know, very loving when he was home. So guess what? They didn't give me this disease. I believe I was born with this disease. I believe I was born an addict, and that circumstances would dictate whether or not it picked up. And what I picked up. I just as easily could have become an alcoholic, a heroin addict, any kind of addict. I picked up food, I think, maybe because it was available. But I definitely picked up. From a young age, I had obsessive thoughts about food. I had, you know, I remember, you know, I was probably 5 going strawberry picking and just could not wait till my mom turned around so I could shove the strawberries in my mouth and not into the basket. And then there were jokes like, oh, we should weigh her before you leave and charge you for whatever she ate. And, you know, I was pretty little when that's going on. And that's, you know, today, I can tell you today, I am not my story. I'm telling you the story of what happened, but I am not my story. I have a distance from it now that I'm able to say, that poor little girl, you know, for whatever reason, wasn't getting what she needed from this life and had to fill that need with something else. And that time it was strawberries. I learned from a young age how to open the cookie jar without making a noise, how to open the freezer to get out, you know, ice cream and eat it before anyone came in the room. I did the hand swipe, and if you're listening, I'm wiping my hand across my mouth because that's what you do when people walk in the room and might catch you mid-bite. And then you turn around, you stop chewing so no one sees you chewing. I mean, come on, this is insanity. This is insanity, and that's the insanity of this disease. I perfected that at a very young age, and I grew up with it, and I got very good at it. So I was raised in a spiritual home. We were given the opportunity to define what God meant to us, and that is an amazing gift to be given to a child. And so I had a pretty clear idea from a young age that there was something bigger than me in this world, and that was a gift. And I got to decide what that meant and what that looked like and how to practice whatever faith it was that I wanted to embrace to worship or to celebrate that higher power. Even with that, I was suffering inside. My home was not completely peaceful. My mother grew up in a really, really, she had a very difficult childhood and was only able to give what she could give. And I know she did what she could do with what she had, and I have no blame for her or ill will towards her. But, you know, she and my sister did not get along well, so I grew up kind of bobbing and weaving and dodging in the shadows, just trying not to be noticed, and hiding and just not wanting to be sucked into the drama, so I was off in the corner kind of creating my own, I guess, and eating and starting to get chubby at about 6th grade and started babysitting. And this is where the binging really began, because in my house most of the food was supervised, but when I was babysitting it was no holds barred. I couldn't wait for the parents to leave and to put the kids in front of the TV and to just eat everything, hide food wrappers under the cushions, wrap them in paper towels to put them in the garbage so they wouldn't be seen. I'm sure there were times I blamed it on the kids because the last fruit roll-up was gone, you know, whatever I needed to do to eat what I wanted and to hide the evidence. And it was a horrible feeling, and I just never felt good in my skin. I never felt good in my body. I was that person at school that was constantly putting herself down, just constantly saying, "Oh well, I'm too fat to do that, and I'm no one's gonna love me." And I just wanted to be loved so badly, and I was loved, but I wasn't able to feel it. So I started dieting in junior high with my mom. It was the first thing we bonded over. We did a commercial weight loss program where you weigh in publicly, you get shamed publicly, and if you have a small success, it feels conditional, and there are commercial weight loss programs that work for people, so I have nothing against them. But what I will say is the first thing my mother and I bonded over, and to this day, I'm really working on finding things to bond over with my mother that aren't food-related or diet-related. And I grew up with a mother who, to this day, says, I hear her every time I see her, I hear her say, when I lose weight, I will ... And I have so much compassion for her because that's exactly how I have lived my life until I came into these rooms. So in the college years, I had some reprieve. I was happy. I was living. I was happy. I had some reprieve until I had a teacher say something particularly damaging to my self-esteem. This is somebody who kind of took me under her wing, and I was studying theater at the time, and she told me that. She was giving little notes to everybody to take home something to work on over the summer. And I was looking forward to it because I knew that some people had gotten notes saying, I would like you to work on Shakespeare over the summer. And, I really wanted to be good, and I wanted to be good at something, and I probably also just really wanted to be noticed and validated. But she told me in this note, I'd like to see you lose some weight and get out of the frumpy roles. And at the time, really, was not that big. I would say I was normal sized, and whatever normal is, forgive me for saying that, but maybe normal for me. I was a healthy weight. I will just say that. But I wasn't able at that time to see that she was projecting, and that this wasn't about me. This was about her. But I believed her. That was the problem. I believed her, and from that moment forward, I stopped. I was going to say stopped auditioning, stopped trying, stopped applying myself, but really I stopped living. I just went into my head, and I chose to believe her, and then after that, any kind of negative message I got about myself, I believed, including, somebody well-intentioned, when I got an exciting call back saying, what are you going to do, lose 30 pounds to be the lead, and it's not something I carry with me. This is just stuff that happened. But it started having its effect on me, and I stopped living the life that I was dreaming of. So I disappeared in my life. And we hear in these rooms that this is a deadly disease. It's deadly and progressive. And when I first came in, it was hard for me to understand what that meant because I'm like, well, let's not exaggerate. I'm not dying, And I guess I could see how alcoholism is a deadly disease or drug addiction is a deadly disease. But I was not living, that's for sure. I was not living any kind of a life. My life revolved around eating, watching TV, period. I was scanning my brain to see if there was anything else. There really wasn't. And that's not living. And so if you're not living, you're dying. And because this is progressive, there is no telling what would have happened next. The heart palpitations, yeah. The doctors tell me I had high cholesterol. In my head, I'm like, oh, well, that's hereditary. That's not my fault. Borderline high blood pressure. Polycystic ovaries. Oh, you can get rid of that if you lose a little weight. Oh, well, what do they know? Okay, I'll try a new diet. And so I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. I moved to New York after college, and that was the one dream I had from a young age. I wanted to live in New York. A lot of people take it a step further and say they want to live in New York and be an actor on Broadway or whatever. I just wanted to live in New York. That was as much as I could admit to myself. And so I did, and it was life-changing, life-affirming. I was building a life for myself surrounded by creative people. But I still was not doing anything. I was like living vicariously through other people. Oh my God, you have this exciting audition, performance, whatever it was. Oh, that's awesome. I'll do that someday. And I didn't know what was keeping me from doing the things that in my heart of hearts I knew my higher power wanted me to do. I somehow knew that, from a young age that my higher power had, big plans, or that if I could only ... then I could ... and I could never figure out what that was. So, I lived in New York for 15 years, and some of that time was I got into yoga, and I had some reprieve from my disease during that time because I felt like I had a mind-body connection. But it was all just a Band-Aid on a really deep, festering wound that was inside and expanding and taking over my life from the inside out. I would have low blood sugar attacks. And I'm sure most people have had these, but I realized recently, I was listening to, I think, an AA tape, and they were talking about a tape, you know, like, I say tape, it's just funny, like, no, it's a podcast, but I was listening to an AA podcast, and somebody said, I lost my train of thought, I'll come back to that. Anyway, I was living in New York, and then 9/11 happened. I was an eyewitness on 9/11. What I was doing, I was nannying, and they lived downtown, and I wasn't even supposed to be there that day. I showed up at work, and my boss said, "What are you doing here? You're not scheduled to work today." And I said, "Oh, well, I guess I'm confused. Let's see, it's 8:30. I guess I could." She said, "Why don't you stay for half an hour and I'll pay you for an hour." And 20 minutes later, we heard planes flying overhead, and we, you know, ran to the windows, and then we watched the plane fly into the building and watched everything after that. I saw people falling from the sky, heard screaming on the street, watched people walking out of a cloud of debris. And I tell you this not to impress you with, you know, what a horrible thing happened to me, but because it was one of the most significant times in my life, because when I watched this happen, my first thought was, there is no God, because if there were a God, this would not happen. I turned my back on God. I turned my back on my higher power. My higher power was not turning their back on me. It was the other way around. I'm able to see that now. But at the time, I really could not believe that a loving higher power would let something like this happen. And I really bottomed out. It was daily binging. And for anybody that was in New York at that time, and it's probably like this a lot of places, we just sat in front of the news. 24-hour news cycle, and because it's what I did, I just ate in front of the TV, and I did that for years, and I was with my now husband, boyfriend at the time, and we both went into our respective diseases, and it was a very dark time, and for years, I really suffered from post-traumatic stress, and I had no idea that I was. But it was so similar to my disease that, you know, to this day, I can't really tell you where one ends and the other begins. I discovered Buddhism in 2005, and I started practicing Buddhism, and I felt something opening up within me. But because I was still in the throes of my disease, the way I was practicing Buddhism was as a perfectionist. And if you know anything about Buddhism, is the two don't go hand in hand. So my practice was not really practice, and it was perfection. And if I couldn't do it perfectly, I wouldn't do it at all. And so there were things changing for me. There was some internal shifting going on. And my life was changing and moving forward. I got married, and you know, I really did experience some shifting when that happened. But let me paint the picture of my wedding day for you. It was a Buddhist ceremony, so it's surrounded by my spiritual practice. We used our spiritual practice in the ceremony. But I was in tears in the room before walking down the aisle because I could not stand to look at myself in the mirror. I hated the way I looked. I hated the way my dress fit. I hated the fact that I picked out that dress. I was manically crying and hyperventilating, and I just wanted to get it over with. I wanted to shut off, get down the aisle. I don't want anybody to look at me. I just wanted it to be over with. And ladies, I doubt that's how you want to feel on your wedding day. But it was dark, and to this day, I want a do-over. Same guy, new dress, new day. Because I was in the depths of my disease, and it was a very painful day for me. And God, I wish I had done that abstinence. But you know, this happens when it's supposed to happen. I started finding I threw myself into some creative work, which was great. But I was a monster. I'll just be honest with you. I was so, my character defects are such that I want to control what people think of me, and I want to control my environment. And I was doing improv, and I was walking on stage with a group of people writing the show in my head, and then literally, I mean, you turn to page 60 of the big book and it talks about, you know, trying to be the actor and the director and the producer and running the show. That was me in an improv setting. In my head, I had written the show, and I was just trying to orchestrate everybody else on stage so that this show would go the way I wanted it to go, and it would have this nice, happy ending. And I couldn't understand why no one liked me. I couldn't understand why I didn't have any friends in this community. And why I wasn't building the foundation of a really exciting career. And the truth was, I was a monster. And, you know, I had one friend at the time, and she's an AA. And I really do believe the only reason she was my friend is because she saw herself in me. You know, she saw my character defects, and she knew. She was able to recognize them and say, oh, shit, this girl's got this disease, and so I understand her. And she loved me. She loved me when I could not love myself. And then stuff just started happening. I fell on a salsa jar and busted my knee open but didn't go to the doctor. And then I was complaining all the time and whining. And my disease had reached this fever pitch, and it was like this high-pitched scream in the back of my head that was always going on, and I was trying to shove the food into my face to silence it, but it wasn't working anymore. And then she went on vacation, my therapist went on vacation, my acupuncturist went on vacation, and I had nobody. I had no one. And this is where, you know, self-knowledge avails us nothing, you know, your friends that know you. You know, when they're not there, you know, your therapist who knows you, that you've had the courage to open up to, when they're not there, when your acupuncturist who knows your body better than you do, when they're not there, what do you have left? I had nothing. And so I had this binge on a Saturday night in August, thank you. And I found my way to a park in Park Slope, Brooklyn, and sat outside the Stone House, watched someone put a sign out, and waited to see if anybody went in, and then found my way into the room. And the next day was my first day of abstinence. And I know that not everybody comes into these rooms and gets abstinent right away. I was desperate and out of ideas, and I really hope that that if you're not there yet, that you will eventually realize you're out of ideas, and that let the people in this room and this program help you. And when I started, I did 30 meetings in 30 days because I didn't know how to eat anymore. I didn't know what to do for lunch. I mean, I was making calls desperately, like on my lunch break, wandering around because I don't know where to go, what to get, what to do. I was that desperate. So I did 30 meetings in 30 days. And in those meetings, I heard the promises. And I won't take the time to read them to you right now, but I hope you will look them up, because the promises became my beacon. They became my light. They became my higher power. I believed that if I could believe that these promises could come true for me, that that I would stick around. And what I've come to believe is that the promises are the beacon. I work the steps, and the handrails are the traditions and the tools. And I can't let go of the handrails. They keep me balanced. They keep me moving safely and steadily up those steps. But I got to climb the steps. I have to work the steps. I'm working step 9 right now, and it's work. I'm not going to lie. I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful to be working the ninth step, because I know what's on the other side. And the reason I know is because of the big book. There are promises in this book, and I want those for myself. I want those in my life. And so I have to do the work. And I also know that I can get through anything abstinent, and I will just share a couple examples of that. My husband and I found ourselves in New York with Hurricane Irene coming, and we were in the zone that had to evacuate. And we're like, okay, let's go to Vermont. We always go to Vermont. It's a safe place. We'll go stay in a B&B. Well, we happened to go to the town in Vermont where Hurricane Irene hit the hardest. I'm not kidding. This entire town was washed away to nothing. While we were there, there was this horrible, perilous journey in the car trying to get out of town. Didn't work. We were almost washed away. We ended up sitting in the high school at the Red Cross evacuation site and watched people lose everything. When we walked back through the town, when the waters receded, it was like walking through, you know, a bombed out town, and everything was gone. The only thing I had, the reason we were not sitting in our cozy B&B is because we'd gone to the store that morning to stock up on provisions. So the only thing I had with me was my abstinent food. I was in a flood, and I was taken care of. My higher power was like, you know what? There's going to be this flood, and they're only going to have ice cream to offer you and Gatorade. So run to the store real quick, just so you'll have your, you know, gluten-free crackers and chicken. I also just moved across the country, and I did that just under 2 years of abstinence. And I did a road trip with my husband in a car for 10 days. That was incredible. We really only had, I think, one fight the whole time, which is a miracle. But I also had my abstinent food. You know, I was able to, you know, I'm sorry, but my food plan is high maintenance. I eat gluten-free and no sugar. When you're driving through Kansas, you do not have a lot of options. So, Kansas, I love you, and nothing against you, because I was still taken care of. There were plenty of subway restaurants that where I was able to bring in my gluten-free bread and exchange their stuff, you know, with my stuff. And I moved across the country abstinently, and I believed that in my heart of hearts I can get through anything abstinently if I am working this program. And I want to share one last thing that I heard an old-timer say, and that is that the only thing keeping me from a higher power, from God, however it is you define God, when I came in, the word God freaked me out. I couldn't handle it. It made my skin crawl. So if you have problems with that word, just replace it. I don't care what you use, cat, Larry, ocean, whatever it is, it does not matter. I believe that there is a line in the sand, and I'm on one side, and on the other side is everything good, and is my higher power, and it's you, my fellows, and it is life. And that line is my ego. That line is my willingness, and that line is my food. And the only way I can enjoy the benefits of a life, of recovery, of good, of everything that you have to offer me, of the love of my fellows in the room and my fellow human beings, is if I let go of my will and I approach everything with willingness and openness and humility, because that is how we are to be of service in this lifetime. And I believe we are all here to be of service to each other, not just in these rooms, but in this world. And the only way I can be of service is if I am abstinent, and the only way I can keep my abstinence is by working this program. And with that, I'm going to wrap up. And if there are any minutes left, I would love to take some questions if you have any. My 11th step, I'm still working the 9th step, but the 10th and 11th and 12th steps, as I understand them, are daily practices. So I will tell you how I practice spiritually on a daily basis. I do what I was told, and that is getting on my knees. I pray. That's not a comfortable, I'm sorry, I'll repeat the question. How do I practice the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps? I get on my knees, and I recite a handful of prayers that were given to me, the set-aside prayer. Please help me set aside everything I think I know about myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you, for an open mind and a new experience with myself, my disease, these steps, and especially you. Also, the reveal prayer, As I reveal myself to you, please reveal yourself to me. As I begin to seek the truth, please shine the light so that I might see the way. I read the steps. I say the Serenity Prayer. I do a lot of writing. I believe that writing is prayer. I believe that prayer exists in, you know, in infinite ways. Prayer can be answering a call when a fellow is calling. Prayer can be calling a newcomer. Prayer can be writing. But I do try to get on my knees every day, and I do that imperfectly. I also make my bed. And, this sounds silly, but someone told me that, you know, messy bed, messy head. And so I feel like I've got to start the day, you know, with a clear head. The question is, how do I work my marriage in the 12 steps? I learned to let go. The first three steps are about letting go. And I learned how to apologize, first of all. I think that if you're married or in a relationship, I think that's the first step towards improving it, however it is today. I learned how to apologize and take responsibility for my side of the street. And then I learned how to say, that is none of my business. I had to learn what was my business and what wasn't my business. And whenever there's something going on, I have to stop and take stock and say, okay, what's my next loving action? And you better believe we have had some Sid and Nancy fights, you know, while I have been in recovery. But that's, you know, that's part of recovery, is learning how to apologize afterwards and how to be loving. And luckily, I have a husband who is dedicated to growing as well. And so we're able to come together in a loving way. Thank you, everyone.